From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 27th day of August, 2026. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Happy 38th anniversary to my lovely bride, Claire Ann. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Matt Bennett of AgMarket.net. Scott Irwin, agricultural economist from the University of Illinois, will join us to talk about SREs, that's small refinery exemptions. Usually that has to do with corn, not today. Things happening in D.C. have to do with soybeans, the RFS, SREs, and the RVO. And then we'll turn our attention to the weather forecast as we close out our time together. We'll talk with Mike Tenura. He is at T-Storm Weather, tstorm.net, online during this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
September corn for the day settled at $5.10¼ a bushel, down 3¾. New crop December, three lower. Settlement price there at $5.33½, and the March at $5.47¼, down 3½ cents. September beans up 2¼, finished $12.56½. November new crop at $12.68, 2 cents higher. January soybeans $12.83, up 2¼. Bean meal $1.50 higher. The bean oil 78 cents higher. It finished at $68. Wheat futures soft red December up 12½ cents. A settlement price at $7.60¾, and the hard red December at $8.22, up 13¼ cents. Live cattle futures $2.15 higher. Feeders up $3.82½, and lean hogs 27½ cents lower. That for 100 pounds. Crude oil on the WTI, $1.47 higher at $83.69 a barrel. And wholesale price of gasoline up 2½ cents at $2.98¼ per gallon. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net now joins us from Becknology Days. This is put on by Beck Hybrids. He's been traveling with them quite a little bit this summer. Where are you today, actually?
Over in Atlanta, Indiana, at their headquarters. So, I don't know, probably 5,000-6,000 people here today. It was quite a crowd, but weather's perfect for it. So,
what did you tell them?
I just told them, you know, yeah, everything has looked good here. We've ramped up. Best prices we've seen in 3 years, you know, and you got to pay attention to that. That doesn't mean you step in and sell 50%, but maybe you get to 50% if you're already at 40. I mean, incremental sales at profitable levels into a rally makes quite a bit of sense to me. So I just don't want people getting too bulled up. There are reasons to think we could go quite a bit higher, actually, depending on world weather. But at the same time, you know, layering in sales to where you know you're going to have a really good year and be able to sleep at night, not worry about black swan events. I think that I would much prefer that kind of risk management strategy.
Okay, so you mentioned a couple of things there that has me wondering. What did the folks at Beck's, maybe the agronomists there, or just people in general, tell you about the size of their corn crop and expected yields?
You know, there's variability. I think one thing that I've heard a lot since the Pro Farmer Tour came out is that people decide to get out in their fields a little more than what they had been, try to take a look at, hey, what do we really have out there? And yes, there's great corn in places, but a lot of folks have said they had more variability and kind of what they expected. You know, and some of the agronomists said that they've seen, you know, nitrogen issues, nitrogen loss, if you will, pretty prevalent in a lot of different areas. So, you know, I do think that the crop is decent size, but you know, at this stage of the game, I'd have to lean towards a number under 180, but nothing near Pro Farmer. But that's just my opinion.
So Pro Farmer leans a lot on Illinois and Indiana. I had some conversations, and you'll hear some of these with the crop scientist at the University of Illinois, particularly after some Logan County numbers came out where they were using 75K as the default for the size of the kernel rather than 80. The agronomist thinks that's right. And Emerson Napsicker particularly says if that kernel is not only deep, because they believe grain fill is going to be really good, but also wide, you should drop it down to 70. That can make a big difference in the size of this crop. Something like, I don't know, 12 bushels every time you go 5,000 kernels. And so I'm just wondering, did the agronomist at Beck talk about grain fill and what they think it might look like?
Yes, I think that the thought process is that, you know, the stuff that's good is going to finish really well. The stuff that's been hurt, for instance, by saturated soils in June, nitrogen loss, something I believe I've talked to you about quite a bit this year, you know, that stuff's probably not going to have a whole lot of chance to benefit, you know, from that same sort of environment. A lot of it's been hurt to the point that it's not going to get better. So I still think that there's going to be issues in some of the hurt stuff, whereas the really good corn is probably going to be a pleasant surprise. I mean, lately, of course, we've all woken up to mornings that borderline chilly. Couldn't really ask for better a situation. Obviously, way too hot and dry for a lot of us in July. But bottom line is we're going to finish really well. So we should be able to hold on to kernels, build that kernel size, and that should bode well for a lot of people.
The wheat market has been leading this week. Why is that the case?
Well, you know, Russia and Ukraine certainly are into it, you know, to a little bit stronger degree with reports that, you know, Russia was actually bombing more of a civilian area yesterday and said they were definitely ready and willing to escalate. And that definitely spooked the market for good reason, you know, and it puts you in a spot where, you know, people, the wheat's still there, Todd. I've told you that several times. Wheat is still there. It's going to make its way to the world market at some time, but we've severely disrupted the flow of world wheat. And so I would look at this rally very closely. If I was a grower that loves planting wheat, maybe I've backed off the last year or two. I mean, you're looking at July 27 wheat at 770. That's just not a price we've been able to hedge out for quite some time.
Okay, now turn your attention to soybeans. This is, and we'll hear more about this from Scott Irwin in just a moment, but because you're in the midst of so many people, I suspect policy, particularly DC policy, has come up, the small refinery exemptions. What do we know, if anything, from the people you're talking to as it's related to the Trump administration's thoughts on how many of those might be granted for last year, 2025?
You know, I've asked several people this question that I feel would be able to give me a good answer. And it sounds to me like there might be more granted than maybe what the market wants to see. Now, I don't have anything more definitive than that. The problem, of course, there's a lot of pressure on all sides there, you know, and so clearly we've seen that impact this soybean oil market to a degree here this week. You know, when we look at oil, you know, you start out the week with, you know, down a couple of dollars and then, you know, kind of flounder around the rest of the week. But bottom line is, didn't really like the tone, if you will. And so soybean oil is 10 bucks off of where we were at just, you know, about 3-4 weeks ago. And that's a really good indication of why.
How much pressure does that put on soybeans themselves, do you suppose, given that, and maybe I should ask what folks think about their soybean crop as well in that same breath?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt, you know, you looked at Pro Farmer Crop Tour and they were 53.3. I mean, I would assume that even with low pod counts, last year, you know, you had high pod counts, you finished super dry. This year, lower pod counts across the board for the most part. But you're finishing wet, you know, and that's exactly what you want for beans. So some of these pods are going to be bursting at the seams. That's what you want to be able to finish that bean crop out. So, you know, whenever I look at beans, I've got to think this crop is plenty big enough. But I do think the trade's very focused on world weather, this super El Nino event. How's it going to impact South American production? I think that's on traders' minds. And part of the reason why this bean crop, you know, is viewed as being fairly large, but yet the bean market's been able to hang right in there.
Hey, thank you much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Todd.
That's Matt Bennett. He is with agmarket.net. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. It's public radio for the farming world. This morning, I was in Mumford Hall to host a webinar with Gary Schnitke, Luke Worrell, and Rohan Seh about cash rents and the price of farmland. It's up on the YouTube website for the Farm Doc team right now, or very shortly, youtube.com/@farmdoc. That's youtube.com/@farmdoc, or go to farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Look in the webinars and events section. It gave me the opportunity, being on campus, however, to drop into Scott Irwin's office. He's an agricultural economist, of course, and I asked him about all the SRE debate that's taking place in Washington, D.C. now. First, though, I asked him to explain the policy to me.
Well, the U.S. Renewable Fuel Standard sets mandates for different kinds of biofuels. And the one that's really in question is called biomass-based diesel, which is made up of renewable diesel and FAME biodiesel. And so the RFS has annual numbers called RVOs that set the minimum amount for those two biofuels that can be blended in diesel in the U.S. And so that's what the mandates do. But then there's this kind of trapdoor, if you like, called small refinery exemptions, where you can exempt smaller refineries in the U.S. from these RVO requirements. And this has been a sore point in terms of implementing the annual RVOs for more than a decade now. And the current controversy is about the possibility that the Trump administration for 2025 will issue a lot more of these exemptions than were built into the rulemaking that was finalized in last March.
Okay, so upfront, RVOs, SREs, the smart refinery exemptions, you said had to do with soybeans. Usually when we talk about this, we're talking about ethanol, not about biomass-based diesel fuels.
Right. The reason for that, Todd, is that this rulemaking had as its central purpose for 2026 and 2027 to, literally quoting from the rulemaking, get the U.S. biomass-based diesel sector back on track. It had been growing very rapidly from roughly 2020 through 2023, kind of hit a wall. And so this rulemaking that was finalized in March for 26 and 27 was supposed to, you know, provide some very strong incentives to get that sector back growing and expanding. And everything has been looking good until late last week, when it appears, without any formal confirmation, that the Trump administration is doing a U-turn on the number of SREs that will be awarded.
What's the potential economic impact?
Well, it's interesting. On the fuel side, so that would be what would this mean for drivers at the pump? Very little. Perhaps, I would guess, 2 or 3 cents per gallon. You might reduce the price of gasoline and diesel, maybe up to a nickel is probably a pretty good estimate. So not much, but it would have very dramatic impacts on the soybean sector. My estimates, I just worked through them yesterday, is that it would reduce in 2026 the production of biomass-based diesel in the U.S. by about 1 billion gallons. And we would probably cut soybean oil usage for making biomass-based diesel substantially. So we would reverse much of the incentives that were put in place in the March final rulemaking with this action, which seems very strange. Why did you have the initial action if you're just going to later reverse it? But that reflects the ongoing political battles between basically big ag and big oil on the implementation of the RFS.
Okay. So a couple of points of clarification. Biomass-based diesel, is that soy diesel? Is it renewable diesel? Is it both?
It's both. So biomass-based diesel are biofuels. Renewable diesel and biodiesel are made with very different processes. Biodiesel is the heaviest user of soybean oil as a feedstock. About 70% of biodiesel is made from soybean oil. The share is much lower for renewable diesel, but it's still large. So that's the connection to the soybean sector.
This is the function, you believe, I think, that is really supporting the price of soybeans and driving it at this point. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I mean, we're seeing, you know, the best evidence of it is traditionally soybean oil accounted for about a third of the crushing value of a bushel of soybeans. Now it's running, had been running 50 to 60%. It's definitely driving the bus. Depending on the estimates that you look at, it's certainly added a dollar a bushel to our current soybean prices, and potentially up to as much as $2. So if you reverse those incentives, you're talking about billions of dollars of lost revenue for soybean producers.
And it will have a direct impact, for instance, on ADM's decisions to expand its soybean crush facilities across the Midwest over the next 3 years.
Absolutely. This turns out it's, you know, seemingly this arcane thing, SREs, but so much turns on it in terms of the immediate economic prospects for soybean production and for soybean processors. So I can guarantee you from the people I've been talking to, there are intense conversations going on in Washington, D.C. about how this may or may not actually be implemented. But a lot is at stake.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Always a pleasure.
I spoke with agricultural economist Scott Irwin earlier today in Mumford Hall on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. We'll turn our attention now to the growing regions across the planet and the weather in each of them. Mike Tenora at T-Storm Weather, that's tstorm.net online, now joins us. He's the president and CEO there. Hi, Mike. Thank you for being with us again today.
Hey, Todd. Well, thanks again for having me.
Let's start with the weather we've already had this week. It's been seasonable and really quite magnificent with the sunshine and drier weather. Has it dried out the Corn Belt?
Well, not too much, and that's because of all the rain that we had a couple of weeks ago. So even though some areas are a little bit dry in far northern and southern growing areas of the Corn Belt, most areas are kind of in the middle, and so it just doesn't look all that unusual with maybe 25% of the U.S. corn and soybean crops a little bit dry as of today.
So that's an account of the precipitation. What about the temperatures in the last several days?
Well, they've been pretty much fine. We've had highs in the 70s and 80s and lows in the 50s and 60s. So most corn and soybeans have been doing, like we said, pretty much fine. The only exception to that will be off in the southern and far southwestern growing areas. We've been in the hundreds for most of this week in Texas, but that's only about 2% of the U.S. corn crop.
When you look forward, what do you see for the growing regions across the United States?
Well, this is where it turns a little bit interesting. We know the next 2 days are going to be fine with similar weather today and tomorrow with these nice and pleasant temperatures. But there'll be a very rapid change to heat once we get into this weekend. And the thing about this heat wave, Todd, is that it's going to last for a while. We're going to see about 7 straight days with highs easily in the 90s and lows in the 60s and 70s. And that's pretty unusual for late August and into early September. There might be a little bit of a break around a week from now, but it doesn't look like a major break. And right after that, it looks like more of the same is going to follow. So once you add all this up, we've put together a number of different statistics here, but basically for the U.S. corn and soybean crops as a whole, the next 14 days are going to be the warmest in more than 48 years of record. The only years that are even similar would be back in 2013, 1980, and 1990, with 1990 being the warmest of all those periods. And there's a pretty decent chance for this one to be just a tiny bit warmer.
Mike, I know you track and model the crop very closely. Is there anything that you can say about the grain fill period, maybe through the next couple of weeks and parts of August and what that might mean for the crop, or at least the weather and how historically it stacks up?
The one thing that we can say is that if we take this weather forecast out about 2 weeks, like we were talking about, and then we look at the past 30 days as a whole, so we'll be looking at basically the next 14 days and then the past 16 days to kind of get an idea of what the weather looked like from around August 10th to September 10th, well, that would end up being around number two warmest of that entire period, going back to 1979. So just another clue here that this heat wave that's coming up is unusual, and it is going to cause some pretty sharp temperature deviations to the hot side. Now, the other thing to keep in mind, though, Todd, and this is where it gets really tricky to figure this one out, but we know that weather really matters for corns and soybeans in June, July, and August, and then maybe the first 5, 10, or even 15 days of September, depending on the type of model you want to look at. But you need to answer the question of whether or not is this heat wave enough to override some of the favorable weather that we saw earlier in the growing season, or is this enough to drive the whole thing, you know, southward? And that's a tricky question to answer, and that'll probably be what a lot of analysts, including me, are going to try and figure out here once we see a little bit more weather.
We'll ask you more about that next week. Thank you much, Mike. I appreciate it.
Yeah, sounds great. Thank you, Todd.
Mike Tenura is the president and CEO of T-Storm Weather, tstorm.net online. He is out of Naperville, Illinois. He joined us here on the Closing Market Report for this Thursday afternoon. A couple of reminders. First, our Commodity Week program will be recorded later today and then posted to the website, willag.org, by about 6 o'clock this evening. If you can listen to it on our home station, you'll hear it in this hour in its entirety tomorrow. Many of these radio stations will also carry it over the weekend. And again, it's up online, or will be, by 6 o'clock this evening. Secondly, if you go to the Farm Doc website, or more easily to youtube.com/@farmdoc, this morning's webinar on cash rents for 2027 and the price of farmland should be posted there, maybe by 4 o'clock this afternoon, but it might be there already. If you take a look, it is a really good webinar from the Farm Doc team, including Gary Schnitke, Luke Worrell, who is with Worrell Land Services out of Jacksonville, and the assistant director of the Center for Farmland Research right here on campus. Her name is Rohan Say. You can check that out again at youtube.com/@farmdoc. And you can also go to the Farm Doc website to see it at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu under webinars and events. You'll find the archive there. But more importantly, you'll find a way to sign up for next Thursday's update of crop budgets, both 2026 and a first look at 2027, from Nick Paulson and Gary Schnitke. I'll be there for that as well. Thank you for joining us here this afternoon on the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason.